You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Martin Indyk, the director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And we're very glad to have you here today to discuss an issue of great and growing importance, the Arctic. It is, of course, a cool place, but it's warming, as we all know, and its warming is going to have profound consequences for all of us, but in particular for the people of the Arctic region and for the countries that share responsibility for that region. It's in that context that I'm particularly glad to have the opportunity today to welcome President Grimsson of Iceland and Premier Kleist of Greenland. Thank you and all the other high-level officials who have agreed to join us for this conference on the Arctic. Because of the Arctic melt, the potential for friction and the necessity for cooperation is growing. And here, in contrast to the competition between emerging and established powers in other domains, you can imagine the cyber domain or the domain of space or the domain of the South China Seas, we see that competition generates friction. But in the Arctic area, thankfully, at least up until today, what we see is a different phenomenon, and in many ways an example to the rest of the world of the way in which the potential in the Arctic area is spurring cooperation. And that is what we intend to focus on today, whether it be in the area of energy, maritime, shipping, the impact on indigenous communities, and in particular the challenge of governance manifested in the Arctic Council. All of these things are on our minds today as we discuss these in a range of panels. The United States will become chairman of the Arctic Council 2 years from now. Canada is about to take up its responsibility as the chairman. And it's in that context that we at Brookings decided that it was particularly important to start to focus on these issues in the Arctic and get them on the agenda of the policy-making community here in Washington. I think it's fair to say that this has been a neglected area of concern, but it's time to focus attention on it. In that context, the Energy Security Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program has taken the lead, not just in organizing this event, but in organizing our policy research on the issues involved with the Arctic. Together with our Managing Global Order Initiative, our Project on Internal Displacement, and our 21st Century Security and Intelligence Center, all of whom have a stake and an interest in this region. We will be developing policy papers, recommendations for the government, and in many ways this convening today will be an incubator of the ideas that we seek to promote in the policy debate in Washington. I'm very glad that in organizing this event, we have been inspired and partnered by Alice Rogoff Rubinstein, who has taken a leading role in promoting Alaska and the Arctic through her own conferences, the Arctic Imperative, in Alaska, and now partnering us in Washington. Alice is a pioneer in this area and is joining with President Grimson and others to put together the Arctic Circle, which is a new organization that is going to promote Arctic issues. And we're very glad to have had the opportunity to work with Alice and her wonderful staff. So I'd like Alice to come to the podium for a few minutes to explain to us what the Arctic Circle is about and her interest and concern about the Arctic. Alice.
Thank you, Martin. You're very generous in your words. Not knowing each of you in the audience, I wasn't quite sure how familiar you were with this map of the world, so I thought I'd put it up just for background. This is, of course, the North Pole in the center, and the world looks quite different than it does on the standard Mercator map that we all grew up with in elementary school. And I apologize in advance for the fact that only Dutch Harbor and Iceland are the words there. This is a slide I used in a talk in Alaska last week. The point of those two is that there is now an increasing consensus, as you'll be hearing from President Grimson, that the shipping route that will become the dominant shipping route in as little as another 10 to 20 years is what's now being called the center route, which is, not surprisingly, the one that goes right straight over the North Pole. And Dutch Harbor is today the only deep water port in Alaska, and that is at the southern edge of the Bering Sea. And the straightest line from Dutch Harbor to another port on the European side of the pole would be to the northern coast of Iceland, and that's why that's there as a hypothetical. Now, one could, of course, argue that the very large white landmass next to Iceland, Greenland, as Kupik Kleist will be telling you, is another enormously logical place for there to be, if not one, then several ports. So with apologies to all whose thoughts are not shown reflected on that map, at least it gives you a sense of the distance and the relative Arctic shorelines of the nations in question. Coming back to Dutch Harbor for a second, the reason the Alaska community is particularly engaged at this moment in helping to advocate for the development of ports is that other than Dutch Harbor, there is no Arctic port, not in Alaska and therefore not in the United States. And if you see where the coastline of Russia juts out closest to the coastline of Alaska, that is the Bering Strait. The Coast Guard among themselves refers to it as the Bering Gate. It's a 50-mile-wide, terrifically ferocious piece of water with ungodly ocean currents and weather systems that make themselves because it's such a force for nature. And the two Diomede Islands sit smack dab in the middle of the 50-mile strait. Little Diomede is American, Big Diomede is Russian. The Russians have plenty of people and patrols and all kinds of military and commercial activity going on all along the Russian shoreline. To the extent we Americans are aware of it, we have nothing going on the U.S. side of the shoreline. So that's the backdrop for why it is that we in Alaska have felt the need to start the dialogue in a much more focused way on the strategic needs of the U.S. in the Arctic, which for this purpose means primarily the Bering Sea, although the Arctic Ocean, the town of Barrow, Prudhoe Bay, they are all along the northern shore of that same piece of geography and with not inconsequential roles to play in all of this development. So I won't bore you with any more geography lessons, but I will say this. We are delighted that Martin and others have chosen to have this conference here today, be it energy security or Arctic shipping. There are so many things that one could talk about. We could have been here all week and put you all to sleep several times over. But this is the most untalked about subject of the greatest strategic importance to the United States in the world that I am aware of today. It is not a hot spot. It is not North Korea. It is not even the Boston Marathon. But if we lift our heads up for even a short-term view of the long-term future, it is one glaringly big, complicated topic, and we are just delighted that all of you are willing to give us the better part of a two-thirds of a day to hear about it. I'm going to be back talking later with the group of panelists who I think in many respects are the ones you are least likely to hear from in Washington. They are three good friends, all indigenous people from the northern part of Alaska. They have been through the wars, so to speak, in the subject of development. Development is never easy and it's never pretty, and they've got all kinds of battle scars to show for it, but perhaps they'll be able to share some wisdom about what all of those lessons learned will mean for the future. So at that point, I'll stop, hand the microphone to our ever-wonderful host, Charlie Ebinger, who's going to begin the program.
Thank you very much, Alice, for very kind words and setting the stage for us. Before beginning, I'd just like to make one other announcement, because I think it's important, and that is to acknowledge that the work that Brookings has been doing in the Arctic has been in close association with the Hoover Institution under former Secretary of State George Shultz, and we're very delighted to have representing our partners out at Stanford today, Admiral Roughhead and Ambassador Goodby and Deke Slayton. We're delighted you could join us, and we look forward to a continued close association on these issues. And I'd also like to thank the very hard-working staff of Alice and my own staff for all the work they've done putting this session together. It's my great pleasure to introduce our two keynote speakers today, and I will introduce both before President Grimson speaks first, if I may. President Grimson is the fifth president of the Republic of Iceland and was elected president in 1996. He is also the first, I believe, political scientist in Iceland and has taught political science during the course of his career. Perhaps most interestingly, he was the Minister of Finance during the international financial crisis from 1988 to 1991, and while often criticized at the time for the way Iceland dealt with the financial crisis, I think proof is in the pudding, and Iceland has clearly emerged not only much stronger, but serves as a model for one approach to dealing with the crisis that perhaps other members of the Eurozone might want to look at. He was a member of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe from 1981 to 84, and again from 1995 to 96, and he was chairman and later president of the International Organization of Parliamentarians for Global Action between 1984 and 1990, and served on the council until 1996. In recent years, President Grimson, I think it's fair to say, has become the leading voice on international dialogues, not only in the promotion of renewable energy, seeing the complete change of Iceland from an overwhelmingly coal and fossil fuel dependent economy to one that today runs overwhelmingly on geothermal power. He is a forceful voice in many international fora on the need for the world to get serious about climate change and, if necessary, to take dramatic action to deal with the problems. He has actively participated in the Clinton Global Initiative and has helped to further clean and to help develop further clean energy projects in all the most of the continents of the world. And he has also been very involved in the Global Roundtable on Climate Change that he was involved in with Jeffrey Sachs as the initiator. And they both met at Columbia University in Iceland and brought together representatives of nearly 100 European and American corporations, as well as experts, scientists, and opinion leaders. He has participated in dialogues in different parts of the world on the restoration of land quality, climate change, combating desertification, and revegetating eroded land. He is clearly a distinguished humanitarian and a gentleman who we should all wish to emulate in his commitment to making sure that we pass the world on to our next generation in good condition. Kubik Kleist is a remarkable man. When you consider that as a native Greenlander that he went to Denmark to study at the age of 17 by himself, knowing not a word of Danish. And he went on to graduate from the universities with a degree in social work, and he has also taught journalism extensively in Nuuk from 1988 to 1991. In 1996, Mr. Kleist was appointed the director of the Foreign Office of the Greenland Home Rule Government. He was a member of the Danish Parliament from late November 2001 to 2007. And since 2007, he has been the leader of the IA political party in Greenland, pushing for increasing amounts of home rule while recognizing that it would be premature to sever relations with Denmark, and he has tended instead to focus on critical issues in his home country relating to alcoholism, domestic violence, and Greenland's unfortunately high suicide rate. And he has been a leader in dealing with all these issues in a very complex environment. In June 2009, the Greenlandic Parliament elected Mr. Kleist as the fourth Prime Minister of Greenland, and it is a great honor to have him and President Grimson with us today. So without further ado, President Grimson, we'd love to hear your remarks.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Let me begin by thanking Brookings and all those who have come together to create this forum on Arctic dialogue in this important town, helping thus to start the preparation for the United States to shoulder the presidency of the Arctic Council in 2 years' time in a successful way. I was reflecting on it on the way here this morning that almost 10 years ago I traveled to this city in the company of Wally Hickel, the former governor of Alaska, who served as a secretary of the interior in the Nixon administration and had a distinguished record in American politics for over half a century. He was a visionary. He was dedicated to Alaska and the Arctic and the global commons. And we joined hands in this city 10 years ago or so to try to put the future of the Arctic on the agenda of policymakers, people in Congress, and the administration. And although Wally was a formidable force, and I tried to follow his example, we didn't have much success. But that was not unique 10 years ago. The situation almost in every Arctic country was such that the future of this extraordinary part of the globe was very low on the list of concerns. Even in my first state visit to Russia 11 years ago, when I tried to engage then President Putin in a dialogue on the Arctic, he referred me to the governors, the local people, in the remote northern parts of Russia, and pointed out it would perhaps be more appropriate that I would discuss this with them. When I, about the same time, went to Sweden to try to talk to my good friend Göran Persson, then Prime Minister of Sweden, about the need for the Nordic countries to get engaged in the Arctic. He was neither very interested or enthusiastic about this prospect and preferred to talk about some other issues in our meeting. The government of Norway at that time was not really either engaged in this issue. And in my own country, Iceland, neither the parliament nor the political parties had really put this on the agenda. In Canada, it was also off the radar screen. And I list this here this morning in order to indicate to all of us, and especially the US audience, that the extraordinary pace of change that has taken place in the Arctic has not been driven by every Arctic country being engaged for a long time in this area. It is, for all of us, a new situation, a new journey. It doesn't really have any political roadmap or any guidelines or accepted philosophies or visions. To that extent, I think for institutions like Brookings, it is a fascinating prospect because there are not very many areas in the world where you can still have a great impact through your own thinking, deliberations, and participation in the policy-making process. In that sense, it is almost a virgin territory compared to many other areas. But the difference is that in recent years, the Arctic has become crowded. We are no longer alone in our interests and concerns. And as a reflection of that fundamental change, I will tell you that in every meeting I have in the last 18 months had with the leaders of India, China, South Korea, Singapore, the first item they brought to the agenda was the Arctic. I was a few weeks ago in India for a meeting both with the Prime Minister, the Foreign Ministers and others. I have been to India for over 30 years, talked about many things, but it's the first time that they bring the Arctic to the table. And as I pointed out to them, it's kind of paradoxical in terms of global politics, and especially the Himalayan region, that whereas China and India cannot get together and sit at the same table to talk about cooperation with regard to the Himalayan glaciers, they both now want to sit at the Arctic table and have a lot of arguments for their justification. So I thought this morning I will try to take you very briefly to the field of action that is now in play in the Arctic. The vibrant activity and interest and politics and economic transformation that the United States will have to deal with in its presidency. We are, however, fortunate when we come to this playing field that it has taken on an enormous positive transformation. This area, which Alice put there up on the screen, was for over half a century, as we all remember, the most militarized region in the world, with military bases, installations, submarines, aircraft, almost every existing military technology being employed and placed in the Arctic region. But with the end of the Cold War, we were able within a few years to transform this confrontation into what I consider the most successful example of positive international cooperation in the 21st century. Because the Arctic Council has brought Russia, the United States and Canada, and the Nordic countries together into a constructive engagement and a new treaty-making organization. With the search and rescue agreement being signed in Nuuk 2 years ago, and Hillary Clinton becoming the first Secretary of State of this country to attend a meeting of the Arctic Council. It was, if I may say so, in this town, high time, that the Secretary of State would arrive at the meetings of the Arctic Council and join the Russian colleague who always has attended every meeting. And I hope John Kerry will not let us down by being absent at the upcoming meetings of the Arctic Council. And with the law of the sea, which although the United States has not signed it, has served as an additional legal framework for positive rulemaking and dispute settling within the Arctic. So when we analyze the field of action which now exists in the Arctic, it is encouraging to acknowledge that we already have a successful institutional framework where the Arctic Council has proved through its track record that it is a useful instrument. It has developed a very interesting culture of decision-making, partly due to the fact that there are only 8 countries at the table, but also being more democratic than any other formal intergovernmental organization by allowing the indigenous organizations and the people in the Arctic who've lived there for over thousands of years to have their own representation in this dialogue. But although we have this positive framework, it is important to recognize that in every Arctic country and the leading economic players on the European continent and in Asia, there is now a complete transformation, especially due to the fact that this new ocean is opening up. For the first time in human history, we will witness the creation of a new ocean with the melting of the Arctic sea ice and the implication for fisheries, weather patterns, the climate, and ocean shipping. That is why China is now already preparing the cargo ships that they intend to use to sail across the center route that Alice mentioned before, starting already this decade using the ice-free summer months because of the shorter distance between China and Europe and America that the new Arctic Ocean will provide. Last summer, the research vessel Snow Dragon, the icebreaker owned by the Chinese Polar Institute, sailed from Shanghai to Iceland. The first time in history a Chinese vessel goes across the northern route to an Arctic country. The main purpose of that expedition was not imperial interest, but to examine how the melting of the Arctic sea ice is creating extreme weather patterns in China a few months later. And I don't know how much the U.S. media has reported on the destruction, the damages, the hardships that the people in the northern part of China suffered from these extreme weather patterns, symbolized, for example, by the fact that almost 180,000 cattle froze to death out in the field, a destruction on the scale, if not greater, than Storm Sandy caused in this country a few months before. A storm which, I have sometimes said, brought together President Obama and Governor Christie in a political embrace. But it is worth noting that it took the melting of the Arctic sea ice to bring together that political partnership in this great country. Russia, President Putin, who told me 10 years ago that I should only talk with the governors if I wanted to discuss Arctic issues and regional people, especially the indigenous people, has now taken center seat on the Arctic issues, calling in Russia in the last 3 years 2 Arctic conferences, first in Moscow, then in Arkhangelsk. And in both of those, he gave the keynote speech. Quite remarkable indication of the transformation of the political priorities that Russia now gives to this issue. And in order to understand it, you should put Obama into this equation. If in the last 3 years, the President of the United States had twice given the keynote speech at an Arctic conference. We all know that has not happened. And Sweden, Finland, Norway, and my own country, Iceland, all the Nordic countries have now made it a key pillar of their foreign policy to engage in the Arctic development. Even the government of Norway, having supported the new secretariat of the Arctic Council up in Tromsø, in order to make Norway the administrative center of the new Arctic Council cooperation, choosing, fortunately, a distinguished Icelandic civil servant to head up that new secretariat on Arctic issues. And then, of course, Greenland, which in the beginning of this transformation in the 1990s was still an integral part of the Danish governmental system, has now obtained, as we will hear, a self-government status and becoming a playing field for a great number of international corporations and political leaders in other parts of the world who have realized that Greenland is perhaps the home to the greatest untapped reservoirs of minerals, oil, gas, and other valuable resources for the 21st century. And Canada, 7 years ago, decided to make the Arctic issues a top priority in the speech, the policy-making crown speech that the Prime Ministers published in the beginning of the parliamentary session. So in this evolution, which has taken place in the last 5 to 10 years, unfortunately, I say it as a friend, the U.S. has still to catch up with the others. And that is imperative, not just because of the interest of the United States and because of the future of the Arctic, but because within 2 years, the United States will take on the leadership of this cooperation. The Arctic Council, as I have indicated, is not an ordinary international organization where the chairmanship is merely a formality. It is constructed in such a way that the rotating presidency of the Arctic Council requires active leadership from each country. That is the tradition and the operational culture of the Arctic Council. Sweden has been very proud of its last 2 years, although it has failed in formulating how the Arctic Council will deal with the applications from China, India, South Korea, Singapore, Germany, or other European countries. But that doesn't change the fact that within 2 years, we will all be watching very carefully what will be the priorities, what will be the projects, what will be the issues, what will be the agreements, what will be the treaties that the United States put on its list of priorities for its chairmanship of the Arctic Council. Singapore has now got an Arctic ambassador. There's a special division in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Singapore dealing with Arctic issues. They are already sending the ambassador around the Arctic countries, looking for a location to build what they call a global harbor, preparing themselves to become the Singapore of the Arctic, as well as the Singapore of Asia. It's a strange existence for a president of this small country, Iceland, to travel around the world and receive in my country one leader after another from faraway countries that all want to talk about the Arctic. Not from a theoretical point of view, unfortunately not very much from an environmental point of view, but in terms of their political, strategic, and economic interests. France was accepted as an observer member state of the Arctic Council, and President Sarkozy chose to appoint Michel Rocard, the former Prime Minister of France, perhaps the most distinguished elder statesman of French politics, as his special emissary to the Arctic and the polar regions. He has been very active. He has traveled all over the Arctic. But in Paris, a few weeks ago, when we both spoke at an open forum, he complained that although France had been an observer state of the Arctic Council and he had attended its meeting, he had never been allowed to speak. And as he said in a dramatic way, France is not accustomed not to be allowed to speak at international meetings. And I mention this here this morning because it seems to me that within the next 4 years, including the American presidency, we in the Arctic family, through the Arctic Council, will have to decide among ourselves how are we going to deal with these countries that have now already arrived in our backyard and our own Arctic homeland and are requesting formal roles, even to be allowed to speak if we accept them at the table. And there is a long list, as we all know, of such countries. Almost every powerful, leading economic force of the 21st century now wants to sit at the Arctic table. I know Brazil is considering when it will formally apply. And it will be left to Canada and the United States to lead all of us in those deliberations. But while we talk, the ice will keep on melting. While we deliberate, there will be others arriving. While we hesitate in making decisions, we will be faced with new realities. And the most dramatic symbol of that transformation, irrespective of our political processes, is the melting of the ice up in Alaska, where this country now, every summer, faces an open border. Because the assumption made by the defense authorities and the homeland security of this country that the ice would always protect the coastline is no longer valid. So as happened last summer, people can arrive on a vessel, doesn't have to be big, and they can land, enter the villages, buy a coffee, have a discussion, and nobody checks their passport. No custom officer is in the neighborhood. The next homeland security personnel is over 1,000 miles away. And with all the emphasis in this country in the last 10 years on homeland security, and I say it as a friend, you have forgotten about the ice. You have forgotten about the natural forces which are creating a new security reality for this country, which you neither now have the personnel, the machinery, the infrastructure, the financial structure to deal with. You only have one icebreaker. Russia has many. China is building new ones. Are you going to face a situation at the end of this decade where not only Russia, but also China has more icebreakers, more equipment, more research effort, more scientific knowledge on the ice in the Arctic than the United States? Are you somehow, because you are too concerned with issues in faraway places, Afghanistan, Iraq, North Korea, Syria, going to forget about your own backyard, about your own homeland, where all of us who share that backyard with you and your homeland want to engage you, ask for your leadership, ask for your involvement, ask for the role that the United States has in the 20th century played in making the world more secure, more progressive, and a more democratic place. That is the task that faces all of us, and that is why this conference here this morning is hopefully a beginning of a constructive engagement by this great country in this important area. Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's always hard to take the podium after my friend President Crimson, who's such a elegant and enthusiastic speaker. Nonetheless, I want to start out with thanking the organizers, the Brookings Institution, President Crimson, Alice Rokoff, and all others who's been helpful in bringing us to Washington today. And thank you for this opportunity to address this very prominent audience. I think it's very timely due to the fact that the Arctic has become the center of the world, as this map shows. We used to be the last frontier. Now it seems like we are the center of the world. And the issues surrounding the Arctic agenda is very complicated ones, as Mrs. Rokoff stated. It is for us, and I think especially for those for us coming from the Arctic countries, a huge responsibility to try to explain the complexity of the Arctic agenda. And also, in terms of speaking on behalf of the Arctic peoples, I always seen it as my fundamental duty to address the issue of the Arctic peoples in terms of raising my voice on behalf of those peoples, and especially the indigenous peoples. Many times I would feel like repeating myself, but every time I feel like I had to really go through the basics in forums like this, because it is very complex. For the last 10 or 15 years, the interest for the Arctic area has been rapidly growing. And usually we would say the interest was initiated by first the climate change, or maybe the interest for the animals, the protection of the animals, and then came the chase for the minerals and gas and oil. And we had to raise our voices and tell, actually, we have people living in this area. And actually, the Arctic area is regulated. We do have our own parliaments. We do have our own governments. We do deal with international agreements. And I want to stress that the cooperation within the Arctic Council are conducted in a very civilized manner. I do fully agree with President Crimson that the cooperation within the Arctic Council is an example of international cooperation when it's a success. Not only that we work according to international rules and international agreements, but also in the sense that the Arctic Council is really trying to include the indigenous peoples of the Arctic. I want to point to the fact that some of the member states of the Arctic Council are not really Arctic countries. But for instance, Denmark is a member of the Arctic Council because Greenland is an Arctic country. And Greenland is a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, as well as the Faroe Islands. United States is a member of the Arctic Council because of Alaska. The Scandinavian countries are parts of the Arctic Council mainly because of the Samis, the indigenous peoples of the Scandinavian countries. Russia is partly an Arctic nation, but in the north of Russia, you have 46 different peoples, tribes or groups, if you wish so, which entitles Russia to be a big player, of course, of the Arctic Council. Iceland, well, Iceland is Iceland on its own. But Iceland being a very important player in the Arctic Council as well. The creation of the Arctic Council 16 years ago was actually basically initiated by the indigenous peoples of the Arctic. We did see a very urgent need for the states of the Arctic to engage in international cooperation in order to raise the levels of the livelihoods of the Arctic peoples, to secure that the Arctic states engage in cooperations to protect the Arctic environment and to protect the peoples of the Arctic. On top, I think it's fair to claim that the 8 state members of the Arctic Council are amongst the richest and the most powerful states in the world. United States, Russia, Canada, the Scandinavian countries. They're all rich countries. They're all politically powerful countries, powerful governments. Governments which have the ability to make a difference. Governments who can afford investments in infrastructure, for instance. The Arctic is characterized by being sparsely populated, poor infrastructure, and a very urgent need for industrial, economic, and political development. In fact, the member states of the Arctic Council have the ability, have the opportunity, and hopefully a strong will to make a difference in the Arctic. We are approximately 4 million inhabitants of the Arctic countries, or the Arctic area, to be more precise. If you define the Arctic area as being above 66 degrees, out of those 4 million inhabitants, 350,000 are indigenous peoples, in terms of people who lived there even before the states were formed, even before the borders were drawn on the map. And what I'm trying to do is to raise the voice of those peoples. We do have aspirations, of course. We do have aspirations like all other peoples of this globe. We want to raise our livelihood. We want to have jobs. We need education. We want to protect the environment. We want to develop our industries, and we want to develop our opportunities. That said, I think it's fair to say that we want development, but not at any cost. Of course, the mineral resources, the gas and oil deposits, as it's been referred to, are seen as the last biggest reservoirs of the globe. But at the same time, there is a lot of worries when extraction or exploration is going on in the Arctic area. First of all, of course, the protection of the environment, which is the core issue, not only for the governments, but also for the international NGOs as Greenpeace, the World Wildlife Fund, and others. Another worry is that the Arctic nations will be taken over by the Chinese, the Koreans, the Far East regimes. When the Western Hemisphere is not paying attention. And that's also one of the core issues that we are discussing. How come that when everybody wants to be a part of the Arctic agenda, that the Western Hemisphere governments does not pay the necessary attention to the Arctic? Especially in forms of at least exposing the interest for investing in the infrastructure of the Arctic region. I usually would say I think the Chinese and the Koreans and the Far East peoples are peoples like us. On top, the looks are really similar to the Arctic peoples. During the world economic crisis, when the Western economies collapsed and the big companies were really sitting tight on their monies, the Eastern countries showed their interest. There was a window of opportunity for those governments and companies to get to the Arctic and take up talks and exposing their interest. I think in order to balance the West and the East and the new world order, it takes, as President Crimson said, it takes for the Western governments to show and expose their interests openly, and to flesh it out by really engaging in the development of the Arctic regions. In closing, I would claim that still I believe that the Arctic Council is the right international forum to deal with Arctic issues. The Arctic Council have been formed to embrace issues relevant to the governments and the peoples of the Arctic. But the Arctic Council is also limited in its mandate. There is a lot of issues, I would not say which are taboos with the Arctic Council, but close to taboos. And that's why I think that the creation of the Arctic Circle is highly relevant. The Arctic Circle will be able to embrace not only aspiring countries, organizations, companies, peoples, and standpoints which cannot be embraced today by the Arctic Council. Also, on top of that, I need to say this. With the Arctic Council, we have an issue constantly popping up. And that's a question of whether to allow the Arctic peoples to sit at the same table as the governments. As I said, the creation of the Arctic Council was initiated by the Arctic peoples themselves, the indigenous Arctic peoples, because we need the international cooperation. But once after the long years of negotiations, after working days and nights, negotiating mandate of the Arctic Council, once it was established in Ottawa, Canada, 16 years ago, the question of the representation of the representatives of the Arctic peoples keeps still popping up. We've been praising and applauding the Arctic Council for being a new model of international cooperation, including all relevant bodies, which is the Arctic governments, which are not sovereign states, including the permanent participants in forms of organizations for indigenous peoples of the Arctic, including observers, and so on. My wish would be that the Arctic Council decides finally to really include the Arctic representatives and have them sitting at the table at every meeting, formal or non-formal, at discussions, at decision processes. We need to sit at the table together with you. But again, the Arctic Circle will provide what the Arctic Council is not able to embrace. And that's why I have taken interest in joining this new, very relevant body. In closing, I want to again thank everyone for setting up this conference. As I said, it's highly relevant. We need to prepare for the coming years, and development goes much more rapid than we imagine, and the ice melts much more rapid than scientists would predict. Thank you.
Our format will be that President Grimson and Prime Minister Kleist will take questions from the floor. We ask two things. That first, when you ask a question, that you identify yourself and your institution, and secondly, that you ask a question. So the floor is open, and we'll take as many as time allows. Yes.
Thank you, Admiral John Mike, the Navy's head of Task Force the Task Force on Arctic and Climate Change. Thank you, Mr. President.
We'll have mics okay. Around the room.
I don't have to yell and scream like I'm known to do sometimes. I'm John White, the head of the Navy's Task Force on Arctic and Climate Change. Thank you, Mr. President, and Mr. Kleist, for your remarks. The Navy and the Department of Defense in the United States has gone on record as supporting the ratification and accession to the United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. Unfortunately, it's likely that we will not ratify UNCLOS before we take chairmanship of the Arctic Council in a couple of years, or even maybe before we have ice-free conditions in the summer of the Arctic. My question is, do you believe if we do not ratify UNCLOS in the United States, the only Arctic nation to do so, will that impede our ability in our role as chairmanship in a couple of years? Each one of you would comment on that. Thank you, sir.
The other seven countries within the Arctic Council have in practice realized the political difficulties in this country with respect to the law of the sea. So it's difficult to say that it would be destructive for the United States during its chairmanship not to have signed the law of the sea. But it would be a strange situation for the U.S. own interest. So my view on this is this, that in order to make the most of the chairmanship in the interest of the United States, internationally, politically, and also strategically, it is politically wise to try to ratify the law of the sea before the U.S. takes on the chairmanship. She had a discussion with John Kerry, then senator, almost a year ago in Boston on this issue. He then promised me in a question and answer session that once Lucas' primary was over, they would bring the law of the sea to the floor of the Senate. We all know what happened to Lucas' primary. But I don't think the fate of the law of the sea with respect to the United States should be decided in primaries in one state of the U.S. So next time I see Secretary Kerry, I will remind him of this promise. And I think we all should, because it is definitely in the interest of the United States to do so. And at the conference that Alice organized up in Alaska last year, Jim Baker acknowledged that while he was part of the Reagan administration's decision not to sign it, the treaty had then been amended since then. So now he was urging the Republicans and the Democrats, in the light of his experience and responsibility in foreign affairs, and he's probably the most distinguished elder statesman of the Republican Party in that area, to actually ratify the law of the sea.
Yes, sir. Good morning. My name is Yannick Salangita. I'm an intern at the Embassy of Liechtenstein and a senior at Howard University. And my question is for Mr. Kleist. What role, if any, has Greenland as a Arctic nation played in your country's decision to increasingly demand self-rule from the Kingdom of Denmark?
As I said, the Arctic peoples, including the Greenlanders, have aspirations like all other peoples of this globe. And I'm a believer that every single human being and every people desires to be as free as possible. Not in the sense that the movement for greater autonomy in Greenland is hostile against anyone. We are not hostile against Denmark, for instance. We are good, very good friends. And actually, we cooperate in enhancing the ability of the Greenland people to stand on their own feet. And that's also a very central part of the new agreement between the Danish government and Greenland called the self-rule agreement. Self-government agreement, that we should, for mutual benefit, work for developing the Greenland nation to be able to stand on in its own feet, both economically, politically, but also look into projects and developments which will benefit both parts. And that goes, I would claim that goes for all the Arctic nations, that the peoples are all aspiring for greater freedom, not in a hostile way, but to actually form whole nations. I would limit.
May I just point out to the audience that most of us have not realized, due to the geography upbringing we got at school and Alice referred to, that Greenland is half the size of Europe. You have to add together France, Germany, Spain, Italy, and a few other countries in order to get to the size of Greenland. That is the territory that Premier Kleist ruled for the last 4 years. That is the territory where governmental leaders of Asian countries have now started to visit. Nuuk is a town where there are more corporate leaders in the queue to meet with the leaders than probably any other capital in the Arctic countries. It's very important for all of us to realize the enormous size. Greenland is, next to Russia and Alaska, the most dominant Arctic territory. And the process of political self-determination, which has taken place there in the last 30 or 40 years, is, I believe, one of the most interesting political transformations that have taken place within the Arctic. So even if it was just for the size of Greenland on its own, It's important for the United States, if you look at this map, to see the important part it plays in the North American backyard.
My name is Rafe Pomerantz. I'd like to ask the President, you related to the, spoke of the challenges facing the United States when it takes on chairmanship of the Arctic Council. Strikes me that, my question is, do you think that the global interests in the Arctic, how will the Arctic Council begin to deal with the global interest, not so much in shipping, but in the fate of sea ice and in the fate of Greenland's ice sheet? Because, this, as you mentioned, the loss of sea ice has now begun to, by all the latest science, affect mid-latitude weather in serious ways. You mentioned the Chinese example. And Greenland's, the loss of Greenland ice is raising sea levels everywhere, including the United States.
Now, you're absolutely correct. When I get questions which refer to China's imperial interest in the Arctic and the threat of China and all that alarming rhetoric that some people use in this discussion, I usually point out that China has a legitimate interest in studying the Arctic sea ice and the melting of the Greenland glaciers, because perhaps no single transformation will have as much impact on China in the coming decades. It is, as we broadly defined, our security, meaning have a safe life, safe daily work, having our homes intact. China is experiencing in a dramatic way that what's happening in Kupix and my neighborhood has more effect on China than what happens in the United States now. And that is why China sent 60 young scientists on this vessel, Snow Dragon, up to Iceland last summer. And it was revealing in a public forum that we hosted with the University of Iceland to hear these young Chinese scientists not only describe the impact of the melting of the Arctic sea ice in 2007 had on China, and we now know the melting last year was even more aggressive, but also to see them put on the map the effect of the melting of the Greenland ice sheet and part of Antarctica on China, where they showed a long list of Chinese cities, started with Shanghai, that would become entities at the bottom of the ocean. And Beijing would become a coastal city. I mean, in this international debate on climate change, I think none of us from Europe or the Western world would expect that kind of message from China. And to me, it was almost historic in front of ambassadors from European and Western countries. These Chinese scientists who had traveled across the northern route came with this message that the melting of the ice in my neighborhood in Greenland, in the Arctic, was potentially having this impact on China. So if only for this reason alone, we have to realize that the melting of the ice is not just causing problem for homeland security in the United States up in Alaska. It has an impact on Bangladesh, on China, on India, and on Singapore, definitely. So for that reason alone, it's very difficult for us to argue that they should not be a part of the dialogue. If they are already, like, for example, Kubik-Kleiskamp described to you in detail how South Korea has established a formidable institute on Arctic research, are providing us with more knowledge, scientific knowledge, about what's happening in our part of the world than we are perhaps ourselves. So we should welcome that international scientific contribution. But then, of course, they also have economic interest. That's clear. And they also have political interest. They might even have strategic interest. But you could also argue that if China realizes, which we realize and you realize in the United States, that China is fast becoming the preeminent trading country in the world in the 21st century, it's only logical they should prepare themselves for the shortest route between China and Europe and America. In the same way as our countries used the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal in the beginning of the 20th century. So it's very difficult to say that we should object or be scared about China already building the vessels to go this route. But the bad news is, of course, that they are doing it because the ice is melting and because of climate change and because this ocean is now opening up in a new way. That is why I say, unfortunately, we have to talk about these issues. Because I would much prefer not to talk about them. I mean, much prefer the ice to stay where it is. But China is not the only country. My small country, and I thank Alice for putting Iceland there on the map. It's the first time in my life I have seen Iceland on a global map like this with only one other place being mentioned. It's a new step in our imperial history. But we are also making use of this. Our shipping companies, our transport companies, Eimskip and Samskip, cargo shipping companies, and our main airline, Icelandair, they will next month together make Iceland the first Arctic country to run regular flights to all Arctic countries when we start flying up to Anchorage in Alaska, and to run cargo services on the oceans to every and between every Arctic country when we will open up in Portland, Maine. When I first talked to Wally Hickel about these future prospects 10, 15 years ago, we thought that might happen 30, 40 years into the future. But now already these two private commercial companies, three in my country, the two shipping companies and Icelandair, will already from next month operate commercial, profitable transport, passengers, cargo routes between every Arctic country. And that should also be a wake-up call to the commercial sector in the United States and Canada and elsewhere. If my small country finds it highly profitable to start running these commercial transport services between the Arctic countries.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank President Grimson and Prime Minister Kleist for a very engaging presentation, and thank you, gentlemen, for being here.
Thank you.
We will now have try to make it a 10-minute break if possible, because we're slightly behind schedule. Be back in your seats, please. Thank you.
Not many people, I think, can say that in recent days. In his role as Deputy Secretary, he is the key leader in implementing the Secretary's priorities for the Department with a broad mandate promoting conservation initiatives such as the President's Great Outdoors Agenda, encouraging renewable energy development on our public lands and our offshore resources, developing conventional energy resources safely and responsibly, fulfilling our trust responsibilities to the American Indians and our Alaskan Native populations, and managing our nation's water supply sustainably. I would say an agenda that few corporate CEOs probably have as wide authority. He was nominated by the President back in 2009 after serving as President Obama's transition team leader, reviewing the Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of the Interior, and the Environmental Protection Agency. Additionally, Secretary Hayes co-chairs the Secretary's Energy and Climate Change Task Force, and he's played an instrumental role in setting the longstanding Kobol Indian Trust litigation and is overseeing implementation of that settlement. And in his COO role, he serves on the President's Management Council and is engaged in the IT transformation and other management initiatives of a 70,000-person deployment. Mr. Hayes graduated summa cum laude from the University of Notre Dame, and he received his Juris Doctorate from Stanford University, where he was the editor of the Stanford Law Review. And he is also the former chairman of the Board of Visitors for Stanford Law School. Mead Treadwell, as I may say, my favorite elected politician. I have had the privilege of knowing for many, many years through our joint association with Wally Hickel. He was elected Alaska's lieutenant governor in November 2010, and he is committed to helping Governor Parnell in Alaska strengthen Alaska's economy by filling the Trans-Alaska pipeline, facilitating a natural gas pipeline, which I hope we'll get into, bringing affordable energy to Alaskans and standing up to the federal government when necessary to ensure access to not only the nation's natural resources, but, of course, Alaska's resources as well. On a national level, he has been influential in bringing about a national missile defense system and shaping U.S. Arctic policy and establishing circumpolar cooperation, clearly an issue on our agenda today. Mr. Treadwell is a graduate of Yale University and the Harvard Business School, and he brings a record of private and public sector success to his job as lieutenant governor. Governor Treadwell is recognized as one of the world's leading Arctic policy experts, and he was appointed to the United States Arctic Research Commission by President Bush in 2001 and designated by the President as the Commission's chair in 2006. Under his leadership, a new United States Arctic policy has been developed and adopted and is now being implemented by the current administration. It's indeed a privilege to have both gentlemen here today. Secretary Hayes, do you want to? Yes.
Should we sit here or should we go up there?
Sit, fine, sit.
Why don't we sit here, Mead? So I'll just open with a few comments. First, Charlie, thank you so much for your leadership in this area. As I mentioned to Charlie on the way over, his group of groupies here continues to grow, and appropriately so, as the small band involved in the Arctic years ago, which always included my friend Mead Treadwell, grows as it should. Let me just make a couple of opening comments, because I think the goal here is primarily to have a back-and-forth Q&A, and I look forward to that. The couple of points I want to make and emphasize is, first of all, the importance of the Arctic to the Obama administration. We have exhibited, I think, how important the Arctic is to our administration in a couple of different ways. First, in the international sector, this administration has been all in when it comes to the Arctic Council and participating actively and asserting a leadership role in the Arctic Council. Mead was with me in Nuuk, Greenland, when Secretary Hillary Clinton, Secretary Ken Salazar, Mead, and I, Senator Murkowski, and many others attended the ministerial meeting. That was a show of force on the behalf of the whole of government, led, of course, by our Secretary of State, the first time a Secretary of State had ever been to an Arctic Council meeting. We have another Arctic Council meeting coming up in Sweden soon. I expect a very vigorous delegation from the United States there as well. And we are looking forward to the change of guard, if you will, with our friends from Canada taking over the chairmanship soon and the United States 2 years after that. There's been a lot of activity through the Arctic Council. It has had a longstanding, effective technical side, as you know, and what's happening is that technical side is now informing a more active policy side as well. And we are all in, as I said. The other, I think, area of illustration of the administration's commitment to the Arctic is on our domestic policy side, of course. And I point to Executive Order 13580 as an example of how serious the president is about Alaska and the Arctic. That is the executive order that set up what we call the Alaska Interagency Working Group. The president asked me to chair this group. It is a deputy secretary group across the government. It is focused on coordinating some of the most important issues in Alaska and in the Arctic, and they focus on energy right now. That is, energy is the economic driver. In Alaska, something like 90-plus percent of the economy is based on energy, and of the state's revenue is so Mead's only here because of energy. His salary depends on it. You can't get any more important than that. But in all seriousness, obviously energy is a huge issue in Alaska and in the Arctic in particular. There's been concern through the years about the balkanization of the federal role in Alaska, with so many different agencies having important roles, from NOAA to EPA to the Coast Guard to the Department of the Interior, with our land assets at the Department of the Interior as well as our ocean-based responsibilities. A tremendous challenge in coordinating all that effort. The president put an executive order together saying we're going to work at coordination across these agencies. We have done that. We have done that for specific energy enterprises. All major permits in the last 2 years have gone through the interagency process. It has led to a whole-of-government approach to energy that I think is unprecedented. Also, very briefly, as we went through this process and the group that I chair, of deputy secretaries across the government, we found that not only were we not as coordinated as we should be as a federal government, but we also were not getting the benefit of the terrific science that is being developed in the Arctic. It was not being presented to decision makers in a way that would be useful and helpful, at least in terms of maximizing the usefulness of the science. So I teamed up with Fran Ulmer, who is also a former lieutenant governor of Alaska, who is currently the presidentially appointed chair of the Arctic Research Commission. Fran and I had a series of internal and then external discussions between scientists and policymakers involved in Alaska issues and the Arctic in particular. Very rich discussions about how best to connect those communities and take advantage of the work that is ongoing. And it has led to a collaboration that continues to this day. In fact, Fran, just a few weeks ago, announced an Arctic science portal that the Arctic Research Commission initiated, working with our interagency working group, to be essentially hopefully this will be a work in progress, but a way in to the current science that is available in the Arctic, organized by subject matter, user-friendly, available to everybody, all stakeholders, and certainly all policymakers and decision-makers. We also discovered, as we went through this process of going project by project review through the interagency process, that this was not really a satisfying process when it comes to Alaska and the Arctic in particular. Not satisfying because we were being asked to make decisions on a project-by-project basis, kind of a one-off basis, without having a vision for the overall sensitivities in the Arctic, the larger questions of where development might make the most sense to occur. And our concern was that without a more holistic approach to the Arctic, without a close partnership with the state of Alaska, a close partnership with Alaska Natives, and I see former Mayor Ita right here, and a close partnership with industry, with the conservation groups, et cetera, that we might make mistakes, and that we would not be executing on a vision that made economic sense, cultural sense, and environmental sense. It led us to prepare a report to the president. We brought this issue to the attention of the president about a year ago, Last summer, we kicked off an interagency effort to step back and look at this broader question, and we produced a report that's available now called Managing for the Future in a Rapidly Changing Arctic, a report to the President. This was delivered about 2 weeks ago to the President. It's available on our website. Joel Clement is here, the Director of the Interior Policy Office. Joel, where are you? I know his bag has about 20 of these things, so you can try to tackle him and get one of these precious documents. I commend it to you. It gives an overview of the change that's occurring in the Arctic, both in terms of climate change effects on the environment, which are stark and rapid. Chapter 2 provides what I think is, to my mind, the most cogent and direct discussion of the science of the changing Arctic that you will find anywhere. And then it talks also about how rapidly the Arctic is changing in terms of development issues. The oil and gas development issues, obviously, also transportation that's opened up because of the ice receding, et cetera, potential tourism. It is a rapidly changing environment. And in that context, how should we be making decisions? And the report concludes that we should be doing business differently, along the lines, I think, of what the President suggested in the executive order, which anticipates a lot of coordination at every step of the way, working with our key partners, including the state of Alaska, including Alaska Natives, and including the other interested players, doing more scenario planning, being smarter about how we do the science, not repeating the science and not repeating our environmental analysis, but drawing on it, identifying sensitive areas, and having a broader vision and blueprint for how our economic development will proceed in the Arctic, and dealing with the big picture questions. If there needs to be a harbor, a deep water harbor in the Arctic, where should it be, and how should we make that decision? I commend the report to you. It envelops this idea in something called integrated Arctic management, and it's the way this administration now will be proceeding as we make decisions in the Arctic. Okay, I promise to be brief. I look at the clock, and somehow 12 minutes went by. So I'm going to close here, and I know Mead has some opening comments, and then I very much look forward to the dialogue.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to say to President Grimson, thank you for your opening remarks, and remembering this is only the second time I think I've been at Brookings, but the first time was with you and with Governor Hickle as we were trying to encourage Washington to think about Arctic policy in the early part of the century, and the Arctic policy that did come out in 2009, I believe, is an important one and a good one. And it's an honor to be here, too, with both of you on this panel. One of the things that Arctic policy talked about was shipping. And I know we're here to talk about energy, but I think what's interesting is this. In the natural resource portion of the U.S. Arctic policy, we said let's ensure that natural resource management and economic development in the region are environmentally sustainable. Good words, fairly general. And on shipping, we got a little bit more specific. We said let's ensure that shipping is safe, secure, and reliable. And I think the question that we struggle with here, whether it's in the energy sector or in the shipping sector, is how do we ensure that the economic development that is happening in the Arctic is reliable? Because right now the situation we're in is it's not entirely reliable. We've just gone through two major setbacks where Shell has announced a major delay in their drilling in the Outer Continental Shelf after 6 years and billions of dollars worth of expenditures, and ConocoPhillips has announced an indefinite delay based on what they say is the unreliability of a government regulatory scheme where they don't exactly know what the rules are going to be. Our situation in the north is that we have a pipeline which is declining dramatically. That Trans-Alaska pipeline, which was built at the time I was in college and is now threatening to be the world's longest chapstick. And it has the capability to produce to carry over 2 million barrels a day, and we're down to less than 600,000 and declining. It's very important for the nation, very important for the state of Alaska, to see that supplies are replaced. And to do that, we need reliability. The other point about reliability is this. is that the Arctic is, whether it's in our country, whether it's in your country, whether it's in your country, Mr. Prime Minister, we are a sponge for investment right now. There are hundreds of billions of dollars that need to be invested in the Arctic for the Arctic to meet its potential, which the USGS found is potentially 13% of the world's oil, 30% of the world's gas. To move gas is a $40 to $50 billion project. To replace the oil throughput at Prudhoe Bay right now, the assessed value of the iron and steel that produces 10% of America's oil is about $18 billion, and we're going to have to quintuple that, in my opinion, in order to keep that pipeline flowing. So investors seek reliability. I see my friend Scott Borgeson was here, and he's talking about the Arctic as an emerging market. And unless we can promise reliability, we're not going to get the investment, and other countries are, and that's a challenge for the United States. Another thing, and I'm again, I'm glad that you mentioned Governor Hickel, President Grimson, but a couple of things to remember about the Arctic. Right now, we are certainly going through tremendous climate change. We're also certainly going through a situation where the world is looking at Arctic resources. But I don't want us to forget that we're also going through a situation, kind of a decolonization, a devolution of power that has been happening in the last century that we should not forget and that we should finish this wave. I look at Iceland, which gained independence during the Second World War. I look at Alaska, which gained statehood, and we told the United Nations at the time that was self-determination for the Alaska people. I look at what's happening in Canada right now, where the crown lands in Canada basically had gone to the territories or to the provinces in the 30s and are now moving toward the territories. I look at Nunavut. I look at what's happening with home rule in Greenland. And the idea here is that if the Arctic is going to be done sustainably, you have to make sure that you keep self-determination in the forefront of your thinking. Eleanor Ostrom, who we honored in Anchorage a few years ago, Mr. President, died last year, was a winner of the Nobel Prize, a political scientist, by the way, who won in economics, for suggesting that if you're going to manage the commons, the best way is not the big Leviathan that Garrett Hardin had suggested in his essay, Tragedy of the Commons. That instead what you have to look at is three E's. You have to look at the environment, you have to look at the economy, and you have to look at equity. In the Arctic, we're still looking for equity with revenue sharing. There's revenue sharing in the Gulf, but not revenue sharing in the Arctic part of the United States. And when we look at the environment, and believe me, as an Alaskan, I was Deputy Commissioner of Environment. I helped set up an environmental crimes unit. I'm a zealot against oil spills, and Julie Gourley, who's here just back from the North Pole, can certainly attest to that our arguments, the state of Alaska with the federal government right now on shipping, are that we need to do more to protect the environment. But we also need to do more to ensure reliability because we're out there trying to attract investment. Of 16 interagency groups right now that were spawned by that Arctic policy, including your interagency working group, we're happy to see the activity in Washington to look at the North. But the state of Alaska is not included in that. A very good conclusion of this report, by the way, was that the state should be included more. We're actually quite excited about that and looking forward to seeing the terms of reference. But we have a situation where there's a shipping report out right now, a CMTS report, where the state did not get to see the draft ahead of time. And yet I'd say if you're going to build an Arctic port, it's going to be with our money as well as federal money. It's going to be with our people. We should be there at the table. There's a new National Security Council Arctic-led Arctic strategy effort where the state has, again, been invited to comment. But it's very important that the state be involved there sitting at the table. We are not just a stakeholder. We're a sovereign partner. And that's a point that we constantly need to make again. Here in Washington, there are no built incentives for the bureaucracy to succeed. And as such, in our state, we've got people who are going to be out of work if we don't succeed. We have a state that is very dependent on natural resource development, and it's not that we're dependent employment-wise solely on natural on oil and gas. We also have a major fishing industry, a major employer. We want to protect that. We have a major transportation industry and aviation, and we hope it will grow in shipping. We want to be known not just for the resources beneath our feet, but for the resources between our ears. I think Alaskans have a lot to contribute and value added around the world. But the fact is that we need reliability, and we don't have a reliable policy that encourages investment in the oil patch in the Arctic coming out of Washington. And we are very, very hopeful that we can see that. Let me just conclude, Charlie, by saying that I chair the Alaska Historical Commission, and we've got several anniversaries coming up that I think are important to recognize. It is 25 years ago next month that we opened the border between Alaska and Russia. That melting of the ice curtain was very significant. And I want to compliment the Department of Interior, Mr. Secretary, for one project that has really kept the door open for some time, and that's been the Beringia project. We had concern that the recent announcement on Beringia did not take the economic development goals of the region into consideration, and we look forward to working with you on economic development goals in the Bering area. That 25-year anniversary should be marked because it's very, very important that we take advantage of the end of the Cold War still and build trade and success in this area. It's amazing that after 25 years, the trade between Alaska and Russia is still just about $10 million a year. It could be much, much more. A second anniversary coming up in 2017 is we come up on the 150th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase. Now, I've heard some Russians say, well, why should we celebrate that? And I've heard some Alaska Natives say, well, why should we celebrate that? And I guess I'll say this. I believe that here in the United States, becoming an Arctic nation, that is something to celebrate. And I believe the welfare of Alaska Natives compared to that of indigenous communities around the world is good, solid, and there's great hope and great potential because of what we have on American soil. But we do still have this debate here in Washington. Was the purchase of Alaska Seward's folly? Was it Seward's icebox? Was it Wall Russia? Or was it a sucked orange? Did we buy something that the Russians had already taken all the best out of? I don't think so. We Alaskans are still trying to help America get a good return on its investment. Thank you.
Thank you both, gentlemen. Mead, I believe it was you who made reference that Conoco says, you know, they're hesitating to proceed until there's regulatory certainty. What from the vantage point, really, of both of you, from both the federal government's jurisdiction and the state's interests and jurisdiction, what do you think a firm like Conoco means when they say there's regulatory uncertainty, and how could we move to give regulatory certainty?
Happy to take a first crack at that. We met, of course, with Ryan Lance, the CEO of Conoco Phillips, about a week ago, shortly before their announcement. And I think I should step back for a minute to answer this question in the context of our experience with Shell Oil Company in terms of the offshore exploration activities that occurred last summer. As you know, we went forward working closely with Shell, who's been a very good partner, in providing an opportunity for them to do exploratory drilling in the Chukchi and in the Beaufort Sea last summer. We identified some Arctic-specific expectations and requirements in collaboration with Shell. These were mutually agreed upon. And they involved and some important features that relate to the special challenges of offshore Arctic exploration. We asked Shell to provide a capping stack, just as is required for exploratory activities in the Gulf of Mexico, in case there is a loss of well control, so you can kill the well through a capping stack. We wanted the availability of a relief well, which we also have in our offshore capabilities in the Gulf of Mexico. And we asked for the ability to have on scene a ship that could contain a spill, that could, if there was a spill, the ability to capture it and put it in a barge, essentially. Those are all requirements that now everyone that's doing deep water exploration in the Gulf is required to do. And industry has come to the fore working together in two major consortiums, and they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars to have these capabilities, which are all have all grown out of the experience of the Macondo well. In the Alaska offshore, we have some situations, some helpful situations in terms of its shallower water. The pressures are known in these reservoirs, so there is somewhat less risk there. On the other hand, if there is a spill, if there is a loss of well control, and we have a Macondo well type of situation, we don't have the infrastructure in Alaska. And that's why we have the capping stack and the containment requirement for Shell. Shell worked very hard to get ready for the – and there, one other special thing about the Arctic is the ice comes in quickly at the end of October, early November. And so we needed to work with Shell to have a window for the drilling that made sense from the ice formation perspective, and we worked with them on that. There were some issues with Shell's ability to deal with these issues, and we did a report about 3 weeks ago that chronicled those issues. My sense from the ConocoPhillips side is that they understand that, and we've been very clear, we expect all drillers in the Arctic to have a capping stack and containment capability to respect the ice needs, et cetera. I think that they will be willing to do that. There is some question about whether Shell will be ready for next summer or not. I think ConocoPhillips will want to be there potentially in theater with Shell and not without Shell, because that provides the kind of mutual aid opportunities that could provide economic benefits to both companies. So I think the bottom line is, number one, there really is not much of a question about what the expectations are for folks drilling in the Arctic. We've laid it out with Shell. We've told the rest of the industry these are the expectations. They're common sense expectations. Number two, we learned through last summer that it's hard to pull this off in the Arctic. A lot of the issues were not, of course, dealing with the drilling, but with marine transportation issues. The tough seas and the challenges of getting up there, it's just a reminder that this is tough. We are very hopeful that ConocoPhillips and Shell will both remain committed to the Arctic. They certainly have a big investment in the Arctic. We're committed to work with them to help them be successful.
Well, when I brought up reliability, I met with the ConocoPhillips people earlier this week before coming down here, and they had a lot of questions about what the federal requirements really are and where they are in the regulations, what the process is that will result from your report. And I think that's a big challenge for us. I mean, this is happening, and I have to say this. The whole of government approach I certainly support in principle. You know, and we've gone through this with ocean policy. We're now going through this with integrated Arctic management. People argue that we shouldn't have stovepipes, okay? But I honestly don't want the fish people in charge of the oil development, and I don't think you do either. And the fact is that we made a decision to lease these areas. We invited explorers in. We asked them to spend hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, and now the rules aren't clear. And I think we have to make the rules clearer faster.
If I can just respond, I think the rules that apply to Shell are clear as a bell. They're in the exploration plan that Shell adopted and in the related documentation. Clear as a bell in terms of the window for exploration, the expectations of what is available in terms of oil spill response, including capping stack and containment. They were clear as a bell months and months and months and months before the drilling season. They're clear as a bell for any – and Shell is the only first company in the door. So they're clear for Shell. We're telling ConocoPhillips we're going to expect everybody who wants to explore in the offshore to meet equivalent requirements. You make a good point. We hope that there will be other companies coming in and that we don't proceed on a case-by-case basis. And we are looking at certainly incorporating these requirements and making it clear that everyone doing business up there should meet these requirements. I don't think there's lack of clarity. I do think there is a recognition in the community, and I would guess you would agree with this, Mead, that Shell had encountered challenges they didn't expect, and found that a variety of circumstances were conspiring, it seemed like, against their success last summer. And it was unfortunate, but there it was. I think ConocoPhillips also, everyone who wants to do exploration 80 miles off of Wainwright in the Western Arctic has got to, with very limited shoreside support, is going to face real challenging logistical considerations. I'm impressed how Shell handled the situation, and I would expect, and I hope that the American oil companies, and I'll put Shell in that category here for purposes of today, but the large responsible multinationals, it is good that they are learning, that they are adhering to sensible requirements, because we're talking about an international situation here. There's going to be oil drilling in Russia. There has been and will be more exploration in Greenland. Norway, obviously, has a huge oil and gas operation. There's a bigger stake here in terms of protecting the environment and providing a good climate for clarity for oil and gas development. I think that because of the experiences we've been having last year, and as we continue to develop, working closely with the companies, Shell and Conoco in particular, Statoil to follow, that we are setting together a menu of expectations that can provide the blueprint for what other companies should do or what other countries should expect of their companies throughout the Arctic.
That really leads on to my follow-on question, which you may feel you've answered. But a lot of times we hear, particularly in the environmental community, concerns that one of the challenges regarding Arctic energy development is this whole issue of regulatory arbitrage, companies operating to different standards, perhaps, in different countries. And, of course, I think the greatest concern is probably Russia. Do you think this is a legitimate concern? And if you do, do you have any suggestions for methods we might use to ensure best practice across jurisdictions rather than have the classic race to the bottom when it comes to standards?
You want to start, and then I'll comment.
I'll start out by saying the issue of regulatory arbitrage assumes that all regulation is on a continuum where there's something that's tough and something that's not tough, okay? And there's more than one way to skin a cat. I've heard arguments about jack-up rigs versus floating rigs, and there are many different ways also to contain, control, clean up oil, so there's not exactly always one way to do it, right? The idea, though, is that we want to get the energy out safely. We want to get the energy out, and nations will have best practices or good practices, and we try very hard to have them adopt this together. When I was at the Arctic Research Commission, we did everything we could to encourage the joint industry program that's happening right now. It's led by SINTEF in Norway. I think the last round of funding was something like $21 million to get common practices and improved practices on oil and ice response, for example. And I can't see anybody in today's global investment environment where, you know, I mean, ever since Amoco Cadiz was sued for a spill in France in a Chicago court, basically, you need to have good standards and global investment to make that happen. The other thing I'll say, though, is that we have to be very, very careful when we create regulation that you're not also creating undue barriers to entry. There are big prospects in the Arctic and small prospects in the Arctic. And I have seen big companies, I can go back to when I was running an air program for the state of Alaska, who come in and say, let's have all these requirements, and it's great for them, but for the little guy, it's pretty hard to get into the door. And the situation, even between Shell and ConocoPhillips, is it's two different sized investments for two different prospects. And uh, if two companies can't say, hey, we're going to go about this in a different way, you've got a problem.
I make a couple of points, Charlie. I think it's extraordinarily important that best practices be shared internationally and that there be an ongoing international dialogue among regulators, environmental ministers, energy ministers, and companies interested in doing business in the Arctic. That has begun. After the Macondo well situation, Secretary Salazar called the energy and environmental ministers of the major deepwater drilling countries together for a meeting in Washington to talk about and share information. There's something called the International Regulators Forum that provides a forum for the regulators to get together. Last year, Norway sponsored in Trondheim a similar meeting with industry, with major energy and environmental ministers that the Secretary and I participated in. Canada has offered to host it later this year. This is extremely important. I do not think that one size fits all when it comes to how you ensure that there's safe oil and offshore oil and gas development in the Arctic. There's a large debate that I think largely misses the point to some extent, but between the safety case approach that is more typical in the EU and the regulatory, what is often sort of derisively called a prescriptive approach, that is the typical U.S. approach when it comes to regulating environmentally sensitive activities. The reality is we need a hybrid. You have to have a safety case approach. You have to have management systems in place that put responsibility on the companies to ensure that their operations are excellent and that they have the systems that will ensure compliance, and you're not doing a checklist kind of approach. In fact, just last week, the Obama administration put out its second phase of new requirements for industry to do safety management systems. Our first one came out last a year ago, September. Companies are now incorporating safety case concepts into U.S. operations, which is very positive. On the other hand, there are some basic requirements that we expect oil and gas companies in the offshore to meet. You can call them prescriptive, but we think they should have access to a capping stack. We think they should have access to containment systems by way of example. We think they may have to pay attention to what our NOAA forecasters believe is when the ice is going to come in. They may have to get off. So there can be some bright line prescriptive type requirements that we insist on, consistent with a safety case, and they should be performance standards. And the containment requirement, for example, as we've talked to ConocoPhillips about, doesn't have to be the Arctic Challenger, which is the ship that the Shell put together to meet its containment. What we want is the companies to figure out how they meet a performance standard to be able to capture the oil if there is a loss of well control. So it's really a hybrid, and I think once you get into these forums where you have the environment and energy ministers of the countries that are sophisticated in offshore development and you have the companies, you get beyond this sort of philosophical safety case versus prescriptive stuff, and you get down to brass tacks and figure out what are the best practices, and each country should figure out how they will incorporate those best practices. That's what we're trying to do, and we're trying to share the experience we're having with the other Arctic nations, and I think that's what we're going to want to do, continue to do going forward.
And just for details, besides the international processes you mentioned, I think we're looking forward to the next chairmanship of the Arctic Council, where there's likely to be more exchange of best practices in this area, and that's going to be helpful. But I will say this. The ConocoPhillips guys, you know, and believe me, I have seen companies cut out of town and say we're not going to be there because of tough environmental regulations or uncertainty. That has happened before. I don't believe that was ConocoPhillips doing this for some other reason. I think they still don't feel that there's clarity there to know what the rules are. We'd like to see that happen. And I think the other question that Alaskans don't yet see is as we go between the state of Alaska and make this trip to Washington, it's hard to believe that Washington cares about getting that pipeline full. And the plan's not working if there is a plan. Okay? And that's what we've got to figure out, is how to make it work and how to have confidence that it will work. And there are lots of decisions being made. We just reduced taxes by an incredible amount to try to bring investors to the table in the state of Alaska. And, you know, our next job, the governor's going on the road, or commissioner's on the road, is to go out and try to attract investment. And we'd really like to have you with us, showing that there is a clear regulatory path to be able to get the money in and to get the projects done.
We are, if I can, Charlie. I always enjoy talking with Mead. listening to Mead and having a good exchange. Whether we're on a cargo plane putting buoys out in the Chukchi or whatever, right?
You or I could have thrown either one of us overboard. Yeah. Sure.
I was hooked in pretty carefully, actually. The Alaska pipeline, filling, keeping the pipeline going, is extremely important. There's no doubt about that. There's shared responsibility to make that happen. I won't go into it, but right now, and the governor's been clear about this, there are tax disincentives for companies to continue to produce on those wonderful long-standing oil fields in the Prudhoe Bay area.
My guess is he'll sign the bill soon.
Well, that'll be great, because that in the near term is the way to continue that pipeline. What's the federal role here? The federal role is the NPRA, National Petroleum Reserve Alaska. Through our interagency group, we busted the sort of permitting stalemate that preceded our coming into office and approved the first land-based development that ConocoPhillips will be developing in CD5. Ryan Lance said, and Trond Eric just said, they're going to be constructing, I believe, next winter and moving forward with that. We have a new management plan for the NPRA that makes it clear that the solution we have there for going over the Colville River is a solution that other oil companies should be able to utilize. We hope that will trigger additional investment in the NPRA. And when it comes to the offshore, I really don't want to get into a back and forth about what ConocoPhillips told us versus what they told you. I just go back to the point that it was a rough summer last summer for Shell Oil Company and for anyone looking at investing in the Arctic. And it just renewed the point that everyone's got to be cautious, go in this with their eyes open and clarity. We had a very good discussion with ConocoPhillips about our expectations, their expectations. We're going to continue to talk with them. We don't think it's going to be a regulatory uncertainty issue that will affect ConocoPhillips going forward. And it's our intent that it not be.
Good.
Could I move on, and then we'll go to the floor, to one area I know is in both your gentlemen's interests, and that is the whole subject of how do we accelerate the development of Alaskan natural gas. We all know we have this vast resource sitting up at Prudhoe Bay and probably gas elsewhere in the state, and yet after all these years we're no closer, despite many people's efforts, both at the federal government and the state government, to make this a reality. I know the advent of shale gas in the lower 48 hasn't made that any easier, since clearly most people would say there's probably no market for Alaskan gas in the lower 48 for the foreseeable future. So how do we get this resource developed? How do we get it to some of our vital allies in the Far East that desperately need this gas, particularly our Japanese friends in the wake of Fukushima? I'd like to hear your prospects on that.
Well, thank you. This has been an interesting year on natural gas. Norway made its first shipments of LNG across the Arctic Ocean through the Bering Strait to markets in East Asia. The geopolitical fact is that with the accessible Arctic Ocean, sources in Northern Europe can now look at Asia as a market. Some of these sources were looking at North America, and the shale gas situation has basically taken away the North American market. And Alaska is again looking very hard at the Asian market. Our governor made a visit to Japan and Korea last year. Our Commissioner of Natural Resources is right now down with about 6,000 people in the LNG business in Houston. I talked to him yesterday. And we are very much on the market trying to get interest on buyers to make a project happen. The three North Slope producers who have never together said we're going to pursue LNG said that last year and came up with a rough project definition earlier this year. And we're looking for a field season where we will see a better project definition later on this year. In the meantime, the state of Alaska has just passed a bill, which the governor hasn't signed yet, but he supported, which will allow the state to invest and play in either a large project or to go ahead and build its own smaller 36-inch to 42-inch project that would bring gas, make gas available to Alaskans. And that also needs an export market to move forward. One way or another, I've always said that if you're going to have a gas pipeline, you need buyers and sellers to get together. And the fact is buyers and sellers are now talking. There may be ways to improve that. The Washington climate is not really a regulatory problem here. We've given rights of ways now to, what, four or five gas pipelines, so I don't think that's as much of a problem. But there is still some uncertainty as whether the United States recognizes that it's in our interest to be an energy exporter. Since there's not much of a market for Alaska gas in the lower 48, I don't think we'll have a problem getting that, but that's the place where we're looking for clarity out of Washington. And frankly, if Washington can make the point with our Asian potential customers that we are a good long-term reliable source, that'll be helpful. I want to make one other point, which is there are days at Prudhoe Bay when the operators are saying to certain wells, choke back oil production from that well because too much gas comes out of that particular hole. And until we have a way to ship gas out of Prudhoe Bay, it is a restriction on more oil production. So this is very important for the country, not just to monetize the gas that's there, and there are people in this room who've worked long and hard on that issue, but also to get more oil development going. So we're excited about the prospects of Point Thompson, excited about the big approach and the small approach and the producers coming together.
I think Mead put it very well. The Obama administration has been supportive from the beginning of development of the natural gas resource in Alaska, which is amazing in terms of the size of the resource. And, of course, the world market has changed in the last 4 years. And the assumption had been, and we have legislation on the books, to facilitate a pipeline coming all the way down to the lower 48. And with the price of gas and the new discoveries and capabilities in the lower 48, that doesn't look economically feasible anymore. And the state has really led an effort to evaluate a different approach that would provide export to Asia. And we're standing by interested in how this might develop.
Just one final question on pipelines, and then we'll go to the audience. There's been some talk that were the Keystone Pipeline not to be approved by the president and the administration, that one option potentially for some of the unconventional Canadian oil production might be to come up through British Columbia and link into TAP. Do you see any TAPs? Do you see any prospect of that really becoming a reality?
We've always looked for ways to integrate our transportation system better with the lower 48, and if the Canadians want to bring a pipeline up to TAPS, we'd welcome that. On the other hand, I have always hoped that Washington could get through its several pipeline problems, and the Keystone is one of them. So, David, I don't know what your
– It's above my pay grade. Stay tuned.
Said like a diplomat. All right, let's go to the floor, please. Again, please state your name and institutional affiliation if you have one. Yes, sir. There are mics coming.
Brooks Yeager with the Heinz Center on Science and Economics and the Environment. I wanted to congratulate David Hayes and Joel Clement in the Interior Department on the report that was made to the President on planning future Alaska, and particularly on the transparency of the process that led to that report. Governor Treadwell, you mentioned a different report which doesn't seem to be as transparent in the offing, and that is a work going on right now on an Arctic strategy to complement the Arctic policy of the U.S., apparently being led by the National Security Council. But beyond that, many of us don't know very much about what is in this report or who's been talked to. I'm glad to hear that the state of Alaska has been asked for comment. I was curious, Secretary Hayes, if you could give us a little enlightenment on the status of the Arctic strategy effort and whether or not, as some of us have heard, it's actually going to be completed prior to May when the ministerially the Arctic Council was made, which would seem to be verging on threatening to be a quite superficial and perhaps mistaken course of action. Thanks.
Nice to hear from you, Brooks. Brooks is a former head of the policy office of the Department of the Interior, as many of you know, and a good friend. The National Security Council is developing an Arctic strategy document. It has been going through an interagency process. I think it'll be a good document. The timing is remains in flux. We were pleased to put the report out to the president to help, I think, inform that process. And in fact, I was working with the National Security Council all through the fall as we worked on the report to the president to ensure an understanding of some of the unique features of Alaska and the Arctic. And in particular, I think traditionally there has not been a sensitivity to how important the issues of Alaska Natives are, of the subsistence needs and expectations of local residents, and the fast changing nature of the Arctic. All of this has been fed into this National Security Council effort in a very excellent way in terms from where I sit of the internal government process. I don't know what the National Security Council has done completely in terms of outreach. But I will say this, that any strategy document is always a starting point for additional building blocks. And it's impressive to me that the Obama administration has taken this up again. It was at the very end of the Bush administration that the Arctic policy document came out in the final throes. Here we are right at the beginning of the second term, and we are coming out with a comprehensive approach on how to deal with integrated Arctic management. I hope we'll have the National Security Council speaking to the Arctic and reinforcing the point that has really not yet sunk in many sectors here, that we are an Arctic nation, that the Arctic is incredibly important to the United States' interests and to the globe, and that what happens up there needs to happen in the right way for purposes of that fragile environment, for purposes of making sure the economic opportunities are realized but in the right way, and to ensure most of all, I would say, that the Edward Edas of the world who live in the Arctic and who have for centuries relied on that ebb and flow of whales, of caribou, of that special ecosystem, that their culture and their rights remain intact.
I appreciate the call for transparency. David, you have this group and you have a liaison from the state of Alaska who doesn't get to come to all the meetings. On this group here doing the Arctic transportation study that was called for by Congress, There was a little consultation. We never got to see the draft before it came out. There's two giant things missing in that draft in terms of an understanding of America's role in shipping. We've got in the state of Alaska, we just finished a Northern Waters Task Force. We have an Arctic Policy Commission meeting now. We look forward to greater consultation ahead of this time because commenting on a report at the end doesn't help if big pieces of the structure are missing. And that's a real problem. The United States keeps kicking the can on safe shipping in the North when it comes to getting contingency planning in place. You have it with Shell, but you don't have it with the ships going by. And we keep making that point, and we don't see it show up in any of these documents. We could write a whole chapter on it. We've offered to write a whole chapter on it. It's not there. We're hopeful with the National Security Council process that because it is a strategy called for by our delegation, that it basically has a strategy to come together and provide the clarity that we need to bring the investment that we need and to move forward. Because the opportunities in the Arctic are tremendous.
Another question over here against the wall.
Thank you. My name is Richard Ranger. I'm with the American Petroleum Institute. In different ways, Secretary Hayes, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, and Prime Minister Kleist have spoken about the role of the indigenous peoples in Alaska in decision-making both regionally and governmentally. Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, you used the term, we're seeing a process of devolution, and you spoke of it later in the context of Alaska's sovereignty. But clearly, there are rising expectations and there are changing modes of decision-making with respect to the role of the indigenous peoples who live in the Arctic. What's the vision and where is that going? Because I think that's one area where operators in my industry may be seeing some uncertainties. There has been a playbook. There's a belief that that playbook may be changing, again, regionally and with respect to U.S. federal interests in the Arctic, regarding the role to be played by the peoples who live there. I guess comment on your visions and where you see this going.
Good question. By the way, I didn't comment on. I didn't know if Mead meant that Alaska is going to move for secession or not. The devolution, but I hope not. I hope not. And by the way, it was a really good deal with Russia, and we should celebrate that. We have a special responsibility to Alaska Natives. We have 250 some odd. Individual tribes in Alaska that we have a trust responsibility for, and how that plays out in terms of impact on decision making is essentially a special obligation to consult with tribes, to work closely with tribes, but also. All residents of the unique towns on the North Slope, by way of example, these are the folks that are most impacted by what happens in the Arctic. And many of them exercise a subsistence culture that relies very strongly on their ability to hunt whales, which can affect and has affected our view with Shell of when they could drill in the Beaufort so as not to interfere with the whale hunt. Likewise, if there is a pipeline coming in at Wainwright and going across, obviously the interests of the health of the caribou herds and other animals that are relied upon. There's no sort of, I think you know this, there's no easy, quick answer that in terms of the input of any community. I would just say, as we've emphasized in the report to the President, that there is a special obligation that we have to get the input up front for indigenous Alaskans. And I will say that one of the things we talk about here, one of the things we're trying to do in the interagency group is You know, it can be hard for industry to deal with the federal government, hard for the state of Alaska to deal with the federal government. But if you are an Alaska native in Wainwright and you want to provide input to the Coast Guard and to the Navy and to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and NOAA on important issues, it's been very hard to do that. And it's not easy to, you know, get a plane ticket to Anchorage, et cetera. We're trying to actually do way better on that. We collected all of the federal agencies in early February for the Alaska Whaling Commission meetings up in Barrow, and we arrayed everyone across the table and said, we want to talk to you on all of our subjects and answer all of your questions. We need to do much more of that. And I think it's that level of commitment and that will be shown by performance that we need to be held to, and that and companies, let me say, Shell, ConocoPhillips, have been good about investing in these relationships as well. They get it as well, and I'm very cheered by that. I don't think there is any dispute about the importance of that. The state of Alaska also is very much committed to that course of action.
Richard, just to add very quickly, I want to compliment former Mayor Ita of the North Slope Borough. He began a process which has continued under his successor, and we also work with the mayors of the other boroughs to make sure that we have regular consultation. Edward, there was a meeting that you held in Barrow that I thought was remarkable, in that you brought in your village leaders and we talked about energy development and state policy, and we've tried very hard to keep that consultation up. On the tribal level, we've seen tremendous gains in capacity, whether it's in health, whether it's in cooperation and sanitation, whether it's in cooperation on other issues, and there's always more that can be done, and I think more will be done. I'm not going to steal any of Jimmy Stott's thunder, but we were in Nome last week at the Kawarik 40th anniversary. He made the point that the standard by which all development projects in the North should be judged is food security, and I agree with him personally. Our governor said on a big mine prospect in Alaska, we're not going to replace one resource with another. And the fact is that the respect that I think all Arctic residents are looking for is that kind of consultation and understanding. That's why we're pushing for contingency planning with ships going by. That's why we're pushing for certainty in regulation so that we can all see what the picture is.
I know Secretary Hayes has to be at the White House shortly, so maybe we'll take one more question for this session. Lady here.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Folks, and I manage Google's Ocean Program. And my question is around when will the U.S. government increase its funding for infrastructure? So part of the problem oil and gas has off the coast of Alaska is they don't have good enough satellite wind data. Ice extent data, like comms, Arctic comms is really challenged. Like it's a very difficult condition. And if, you know, the Coast Guard's funding has been cut, like when will we increase the Coast Guard's funding so they have more icebreakers, so that we have greater safety and security for mariners, so that Alaskans can make sure that they avoid what happened in the Gulf with the Deep Horizon? Thank you.
The President's budget that was introduced and made public a week ago or so has good budgeting for Alaska related issues. Unfortunately, in amounts that are not well correlated to what the Congress has authorized for the many agencies involved in Alaska. It's a very important point, and I think that funding's always going to be hard for these activities. I am cheered by several quick points. One is the attention that we are all collectively giving to this important area of the world. And funding can follow if there's a shared understanding of the importance of the Arctic. And I want to thank all of you in your own way for helping raise the profile of the Arctic, because funding can follow. Secondly, I think the National Security Strategy document that is underway has the potential to be very helpful in raising the profile of the importance of some of these infrastructure issues. And thirdly, I agree with Mead. The reality is that I think that for funding major infrastructure going forward, it's got to be a collaboration between the federal government, the state government, and private parties. And we've got to find a new way to work together. And having a blueprint of integrated Arctic management for what's needed and working truly in partnership with the residents of the area, with the state, and with the major private players, that's what we have to do. We have not done that yet in this country in a meaningful way. We have the chance to do it in the Arctic, and I commend all of you to work with us collectively toward that end.
We are putting up money where we can as a state. It's been the state that's put up a significant money for the automatic identification systems to make sure we know what boats are coming by. We are putting up the money. There's money in the capital budget this year to continue the port study. We've got another couple hundred thousand dollars looking at the role of the Aleutian ports. We have provided leasing for the Coast Guard to move their helicopters north. Our National Guard and the Coast Guard are working very much together on that. And we agree with you. In fact, the state of Alaska has even said we would consider working with the Coast Guard on financing icebreakers. It's very, very important that, you know, this is half the nation's coastline. And I've had senior Coast Guard admirals say, well, I'm not sure we can afford Alaska. And my answer is I'm not sure we can afford California. I mean, the fact is that this is a sovereign part of our country that we have to protect and we have to stand up for it. The Bush policy was held up for 6 or 8 months over two, I like to say, food fights, but one of them was whether or not we could say anything about the need for icebreakers. And let me say it here because it's very hard for a federal official to say it. The state of Alaska believes we got to have icebreakers. And there's a dozen reasons I'll give you why.
I'm for icebreakers too. but you can't quote me on that. No. Can I close with one illustration that provides hope for the future along these lines? It is ridiculous, but we do not have good mapping capability for the topography of Alaska. And the state of Alaska came to us and said, we got to fix this problem. And we collaborated together. The state threw in some money. We at the Interior Department sponsored an across-the-government effort that ultimately has been a tin cup effort to find funding from a lot of different sources. We're going to get that done. And the reason we're getting it done is because we're working together collaboratively. We see the need, and we're working across our governments to make it happen. That's in a small scale
and
what we need to do.
And you put the state at the table at the beginning.
Absolutely.
We showed up with resources,
absolutely.
And we're there at every meeting.
Absolutely.
I need you to work on EPA for me, but that's a different story.
Okay.
I want to thank Secretary Hayes and Governor Treadwell for a very charming, enlivening discussion, which I expected.